Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday. The 5th of June. Mondays at 9, we do all things political, and we get great guests from broadcasting or political scientists to talk about the news in Washington and around the world, the political news of the big stories of the past 5 or 6 days. We're very happy to have with us this hour Michael Rowland. He is Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. I think it's always interesting to have an international perspective on the news that's coming out of Washington. Michael has been with the ABC for 18 years, reporting for a range of radio and TV news and current affairs programs with a particular focus on politics and finance. In the 1990s, he spent 5 years in the Parliament House Bureau filing for radio news. We have a lot to talk about. Immigration, of course, on our agenda this morning. And how is immigration handled in Australia? Do a lot of people want to move to Australia? We'll be looking at warring Palestinians. Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City, changing his registration from Republican to unaffiliated. The presidential race, which is still going on, and it's a long one. We'll look at global warming. We'll talk about European human rights groups. Stories over the weekend that there are many secret prisons in Europe, and we'll look at that story. We'll look at the vote last week by the U.S. Senate to raise fuel economy mandates. Again, an international perspective will be interesting. And we'll also look at whatever else you want to talk about. Who's hot and who's not on the Republican presidential ticket and the Democratic presidential ticket. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee number is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. And Michael, thank you ever so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. Let's start with our presidential race, which you must think is terribly long.
Yes, well, I'm fatigued just covering it, and I can only imagine what the 18 candidates are feeling now. What is it, 14, 15 months before Election Day? It's just amazing how early it started. I'm used to covering federal election campaigns in Australia that run for 33 days. Not 33 months. No.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I wonder why they are starting this early. I was having ice cream with some friends last night, and I brought up the political race. And, no, everybody said it's way too early. We don't know who we're for. It's way too early. It's way too early. So why are we doing this so early if nobody's really involved in the race right now?
Well, I mean, as best as I can imagine, it's the fact that it is the most open presidential race since, 1952, I think, is the last time when we had a completely open field on both the Republican and Democratic sides of the ledger. For the last few presidential campaigns, there's been an incumbent president or vice president running. So I figure, particularly amongst the Democrats, that they see this as their best chance of getting the keys to the White House for so many years, particularly as they're campaigning on what they see as the incompetency and the mistakes made by the Bush administration since 2000.
Right. Michael Bloomberg, is he going to be a big power broker in this race?
I think he will. I think he'll run. He has been. I'm very, very amazed or awestruck by his media skills over the last couple of weeks. He's played it perfectly. There he was on the cover of Time magazine with Arnold Schwarzenegger, a very positive profile on their respective post-partisan approach to politics. Then the next day or 2 days later came his stunning announcement that he was dumping the Republicans and signing up as an independent. And then, of course, he was doing nothing to dampen that speculation that he would run for president in subsequent news conferences over the course of the rest of last week. I think he'll run. He's certainly got the money to spend on a campaign and the money to, more importantly, wait on the sidelines until he thinks it's most opportune to jump into the race. I obviously don't think he's going to win because of the inbuilt advantages to the two big parties in your electoral system here, but he could play kingmaker. Mm-hmm. There was a very interesting article in the Washington Post over the weekend that put up the theory that all he has to do was to win the electoral college votes of some big states such as Florida, California, the care of his friend Arnold Schwarzenegger, and if it was a tight election, he could hold the keys to determine who does get over the line in November next year. So I think he'll run. He won't win, but he'll certainly prove to be a decisive factor, and also a decisive factor in getting on the into the public sphere of some of the issues that the major party candidates perhaps quite for obvious reasons don't want to talk about between now and Election Day. So it can be nothing but positive, I think, for the US electoral system.
Yeah. How do you deal with money in politics in Australia? Would it be unheard of to have a billionaire come in and say, I'm going to run for president?
Yeah, it's been unheard of so far. By definition, we have 20 million people in Australia versus your 300 million. So the number of billionaires is much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole issue of raising money for financing campaigns in Australia is much more subdued in from where I come from. Of course, both of our major political parties do need money to run campaigns, to run those attack advertisements, to put out candidates in as many seats as possible. But there isn't this furious scrambling for cash that we're seeing so far mm-hmm. away from the election, with candidates literally going from fundraiser to fundraiser, with their hats out trying to raise in many respects are obscene amounts of money this far out from the
right.
election. Things are, and in Australia there's still a very high degree of public financing of electoral campaigns. So, and I think we're seeing increasing signs of some of the leading candidates here ditching putting their hands out for public financing at all in this November for the campaign for next year.
Yeah. Let's talk about Iraq for a moment. Somebody in the LA Times saying last week, asking the question, is the war still winnable? And answering, the Iraq war is already lost. Today, in the middle of this surge, it's every single day these reports. Suicide bomber penetrated layers of security, blowing himself up in the busy lobby of a leading Baghdad hotel, killing 12 people, including a U.S. ally, tribal sheik. 21 others were wounded. Just one in a surge of 5 suicide and other bombings on Monday that killed at least 45 people across Iraq. Is this war lost?
Well, that's the to use an overused cliche, that's the $64,000 question. I certainly don't think it's winnable. We now have the surge, the extra, 5 brigades in Baghdad and elsewhere on the ground now, and it is still early days, and the U.S. military can be believed that they need a bit more time to get this so-called surge working more effectively. But the odds against this new Baghdad security plan, this new Iraq security plan, do have to be stacked against the against America's favor, and for that matter, the favor of its coalition allies, including Australia. We also have troops on the ground in Iraq. I find it very hard to see a solution that doesn't involve at least a gradual withdrawal of American troops, perhaps as early as the end of this year, but certainly moving into next year, that the violence seems to be so entrenched, the flow of foreign fighters across the borders from other countries into Iraq seems to be well established. I just really think, and we're seeing what the death toll, 70 or 80 U.S. servicemen and women killed this month alone. I mean, it's absolutely horrific figures, and it's going to get worse as the surge takes effect and U.S. soldiers move out of their bases into the dangerous streets of Baghdad and Anbar province west of the Iraqi capital. Obviously, that death toll is going to increase even further, and I just really think that we're going to see a Vietnam-style withdrawal, at some stage over the next 12 months.
It is so sad, isn't it? And I'm not numb to it, but every single day for years now, all these people are dying.
That's right. I mean, it is very hard to get a bit of Iraq fatigue and not consider the human costs of, on one day 5 American servicemen dying, on another day 3, on another day 7. Tremendous impact on their families and friends, and also, you'd have to think on the social fabric here, and I know a lot of Americans, and for that matter a lot of Australians, at this stage inured to the devastating human cost of the Iraq war. But there has to be a stage when perhaps is it going to be, the U.S. death toll hitting 4,000, more vicious sectarian fighting in Baghdad. There has to be a stage when a tipping point is reached, and public pressure alone will force the Bush administration to reconsider its options in Iraq.
Yeah. Michael, last week the Senate voting to increase fuel standards, 65 to 27. The automakers were lobbying heavily on this. I'm interested in an Australian perspective on this as well. A, do you think, were you surprised that this happened, that Detroit didn't have the lobbying power that perhaps they used to have? And B, do you have fuel mandates in Australia?
On the second question, I must say I'm not too sure. I know there has been a campaign now for some years to establish these fuel standards, and mind you, what happens in our auto industry fairly closely follows what happens in the US auto industry. So if they haven't happened already, I think the events of the last few weeks might give the proponents of fuel economy standards a bit more heart. But certainly there is a big campaign to reduce the sort of automotive emissions in Australia. The climate change debate in Australia is huge. We're just coming off the back of one of our worst, if not the worst, droughts in Australian history, which has concentrated the public's mind tremendously on ways of mitigating the impact of greenhouse gas emissions and mm-hmm. emissions from cars. So certainly what has happened in the US Congress over the last week and what's going to happen in the Senate this week as the fight continues is going to be closely watched by certainly the Australian public, the Australian government, and the Australian arms of the big US auto companies.
Mm-hmm. Do you, on the whole, drive smaller cars in Australia, or are you SUV people as well?
No, the SUV culture really hasn't taken hold in Australia.
No.
They're there, but nowhere near the amount of big SUV type cars that you see on the roads in any big American city. You tend to see more medium sized sedans and certainly a lot of smaller cars. But our gasoline prices have been very high for a long period of time, and when you compare, we pay prices in litres of gasoline versus your gallon, but on that comparison, our prices have been so much higher than the cost you pay at the Bowser for so many years,
mm-hmm.
which is already forcing many people, even if they were dreaming about buying an SUV, to put off those dreams for another few years at least.
Mm-hmm. Michael, do you think there will be an immigration bill passed in the next few months?
You'd have to say it's fairly unlikely, given what seems like the fairly entrenched opposition by key Republicans in both the House and the Senate. I know the President is very exceptionally keen to get something resembling an immigration reform bill passed, given that if that was passed, it'd be really, given his time in the White House is running out, his sole domestic legacy. But he's going to have to do a fair bit more arm-twisting to get a positive reaction in the Senate. I just think the Republican sentiment, and also obviously the sentiment amongst some conservative Democrats against the notion, true or otherwise, of granting amnesty to the 12 million illegal immigrants living here, is going to be too strong to overcome. And I think, just a guess at this stage, I'm not as closely tuned in as I'd like to the halls of the US Congress here, but I think it's going to be very tough for this immigration reform to survive the US Congress.
And what about how this issue plays in the presidential race? Will it be way up there in terms of interest in this issue and debate about the issue?
I think it will, certainly amongst the border states. It will. It's going to be as it was in the congressional campaign before last year's midterm elections. But I think it's going to come down, be a second, third, fourth order issue behind Iraq, which I think is going to be the overriding issue in the campaign, particularly if we still have, America still has a large number of troops over there as we head into the business end of the election campaign next year.
We're going to welcome phone calls from Michael. Here's our phone number. It's All Things Political is our conversation Monday mornings at 9 o'clock. Michael is the Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He reports for radio and TV news and current affairs programs for Australia with a particular focus on politics and finance. And we're looking at a number of issues here, certainly Michael Bloomberg or the presidential race here in the United States, whether or not the war in Iraq is already lost, the beginning of the major assault on al-Qaeda in Iraq. Is this war still winnable? We're talking about CAFE standards and the Senate voting last week, 65 to 27, to approve fuel economy regulations. We can spend a great deal more time talking about global warming. What we have yet to get to, a European human rights group talking about secret prisons in Europe. How do you get to stories like that? And whatever you'd like to bring up. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. All of our lines are open at this very moment, so take one if you'd like. Michael Rowland, Washington correspondent for the Australia Broadcasting Corporation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael Rowland is our guest, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. All things political is our conversation this first hour, and our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls today with Amy from Appleton. Hi, Amy.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment, I'm still quite frustrated with the fact that the media in America is not covering the disdain that the world has basically for our sitting president and the policies that he's taken us through in many realms. But my biggest question, I guess, is what is the rest of the world really feeling about our lack in participation to try to have some response to global warming? And with the recent summits in Europe, it just seems like we don't hear how disgusted the rest of the world is with us. And I'd like to hear a comment about that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Amy. Michael?
Well, on climate change, our Prime Minister, John Howard, has been one of the sole international supporters of George Bush's position on climate change, in that Australia was one of about the only other countries other than the United States that didn't agree to sign up to the Kyoto Protocol on reducing greenhouse gases. John Howard, up until fairly recently, he's changed his rhetoric of late slightly in the last few months, but has been a noted climate change skeptic about the human impact on greenhouse gases and ways that detrimentally affects climate change. So there's, and he's been copying a fair bit of stick about that at home because of the impact, the obvious impact that climate change in many people's eyes is having, care of the drought we've had. And just on Australians' view of George Bush, it's fair to say, and opinion polls in Australia do bear this out, that the US president is deeply unpopular with Australians. Australians love Americans. There's been this deep affinity between our two countries for decades, forged particularly in the dark days of World War II, when America essentially came to our rescue, to rescue us from the advancing Japanese army in the Pacific War. But certainly over the last few years, while that residual affinity between Australians and Americans remains, there is a lot of anger in sections of Australian society about the various policies, be it Iraq, be it climate change, be it Guantanamo Bay, the various policies that this administration has embarked upon.
And we thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Mike from Madison next time, Mike.
Good morning. Morning, Michael.
Hi, Mike.
What's the U.S. Constitution precludes the possibility of Arnold Schwarzenegger being the president, but what's the possibility that Bloomberg would bring him along as his vice presidential running mate and thereby pulling along California's 40-some electoral votes?
It's a fascinating prospect, isn't it? I had taken the time to have another skim through the U.S. Constitution after the events surrounding Michael Bloomberg last week, and it makes no reference to the vice president's place of birth. Obviously, if you want to be president, the Constitution says you do have to be born in the United States, but there's interestingly, no reference to the heritage of the vice president. So on that basis, there's nothing to stop a Michael Bloomberg, Arnold Schwarzenegger ticket, which would be formidable in many people's eyes. And as you say, Mike, would certainly put California in play for this third party ticket, and therefore, and given the amount of votes that California offers to the Electoral College, would potentially be decisive if the election was as close as the one, say, in 2000.
And then to follow up on that, what should happen if Bloomberg were to leave office and therefore the vice president would be the next in line for the presidency? What a conundrum that would be for us to disallow the vice president. We would have a real problem there. You know, Arnold was the vice president. Shouldn't he naturally then become president, or, because the Constitution disallows it? we would move on to the third in line.
Well, one thing you can say for sure, Mike, is that it'd be an instant cottage industry for constitutional lawyers to work out a solution to that. I must say they have better minds on the US Constitution than I would, but I can tell you, as a journalist, if that situation did present itself, it'd be a terrific story to cover.
Yeah. Would you like such a ticket? Could you get behind that, Mike?
I really could get behind it. Even just Bloomberg, I'm kind of a middle-of-the-road person anyway. I'm not solid Republican or Democrat, and I tell you, Bloomberg coming in really has, you know, my thoughts pulled away from Hillary or Obama, and you know, I'm going to pay attention to Bloomberg, and definitely if you had Schwarzenegger on the ticket, really would be interesting. It'd be tough for me to not vote for them.
Interesting. Thanks very much for the call. What would a Bloomberg run do to the Hillary and Obama campaigns, would you say, Michael?
I think he would hurt the Democratic campaigns more than he would Republicans, because he is at heart a Democrat. He only switched party allegiances to get into the mayoral's chair in the first place. He is very liberal on social issues, and that would hurt the campaigns, particularly of the front runners, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And in many people's eyes, he'd provide a more popular New York choice than Hillary Clinton would. So I think there's a fair bit more nervousness in Democratic ranks than GOP ranks about Michael Bloomberg's very public flirtation with a presidential campaign run.
Thanks so much for your call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Michael Rowland is our guest, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Julia is our next caller. Hi, Julia.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen and Michael. My comment is that somewhat similar to the last person's, or I carry on from his, is that people in the United States would not vote for Bloomberg and Schwarzenegger because Schwarzenegger couldn't ascend, as it were, to the presidency, and they would think that was a failed vote. I think most of the people here don't think beyond that concept. But my original thought was that I've got extreme fatigue over Iraq. I'm ex-Peace Corps. I'm an ex-activist. I don't even... Today's the first day I've listened to the radio in 2 weeks. I am so...
Oh, my.
Well, I'm so tired of all the death. I mean, I've got another nephew going now. And it's just like sending lambs to slaughter. I can't even deal with it anymore. And I don't know what to do. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't, obviously, deal with this president. He says he's Christian. He's not my kind of Christian. He doesn't pray to my God, because my God doesn't kill people. It's just horrific in my mind. I'm with the Australian people, as are many people around me, that we're very fed up with a lot of policies that the U.S. has, from everything you mentioned, Michael, Guantanamo and the Kyoto Accord, and you name it, we're against it from this country. But we have no voice anymore. I don't think we're a democracy or a republic anymore. I don't think people out in the country are even listened to.
Michael?
Well, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because the 2006 congressional campaign was largely seen as a national referendum on the war, a referendum the Democrats won on a campaign to start bringing U.S. troops home. And in many American voters' minds, they thought that, well, that was great. They'd have a mandate to at least force the president to start thinking about pulling U.S. troops home. But we all saw what happened with their attempts to insert deadlines into the latest Iraq funding bill. And I suppose quite rightly, some of the Democrats are copping a bit of flak from anti-war groups for not being more aggressive in their campaign to start pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq. But on the broader front, I just think that this president is so determined to secure that victory, quote-unquote, that he's going to stay the course. And then there might be some troop withdrawals around the edges, but he is essentially going to be playing for time, and that clock for him will expire on January the 20th or the 21st, 2009, whenever inauguration date is for the next president. Then it'll be somebody else's problems. I just think it's not just the president, but other key administration officials are so committed to trying to get some positive out of Iraq that they're going to press ahead with, I'd say, not sending any more troops, but certainly keeping a large troop presence on the ground in Iraq.
What about Republican pressure as the election nears? It seems a long way away, but pretty soon it won't be that far away. What about the pressure on the president to change course, or the Republicans could face massive defeat in 08?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, how the Republican candidates have been treating George Bush with kid gloves at this stage. You've got the likes of John McCain very publicly, as he has been saying for some time now, talking about the mistakes that were made in the execution of the war. But by and large, all the Republican candidates do support the mission in Iraq, and it'll be therefore very, very interesting to see how their rhetoric may change as we head towards the primaries early next year, and certainly in the course of a general election campaign, if the Iraq war is still raging and if there are still a large number of American troops fighting and dying in Iraq. I think the sheer demands of political expediency might force some of these Republican candidates and whoever the Republican nominee is to go in much harder against the president, even though that will be extremely difficult to do in many respects.
Thank you, Julia, so much for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political this hour with Michael Rowland, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. We go to Michael next from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, good morning. Couple of things. First of all, I want to straighten you guys out a little bit. There's no cottage industry among constitutional lawyers trying to figure out if Schwarzenegger can run or not for vice president. The 12th Amendment to the Constitution, the last sentence reads, "But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to that of vice president of the United States." I don't know how this quote controversy got started, this idea that he could be vice president, but he clearly can't. My question for this guy from Australia is, I was wondering if he had any take on how Australians and particularly the Australian Prime Minister responded to Obama's challenge to the Prime Minister that if he was so supportive of the Iraqi war, he should be sending more troops in to support us in that fight. And I haven't really heard any response to that.
I think, summarizing what happened there, our Prime Minister John Howard took a swipe at Barack Obama. I think it was early this year, around the time that Barack Obama announced his candidacy. Mr. Howard attacked his calls for a troop withdrawal deadline from Iraq. Barack Obama very quickly swung back and said, "Yes, well, if you're really serious, Mr. Howard, about seeing some conclusion to this war, send more troops over to Iraq. Australia has only about 1,500 troops on the ground in Iraq compared to your 160,000. I'd have to say it was Barack Obama 1, John Howard 0. The reason you didn't hear a response was that there really wasn't a response. There really wasn't anywhere Mr. Howard could go. It was a very, very clever response by Barack Obama, which essentially knocked the issue dead.
And what about thoughts about Obama? Is he getting a lot of press coverage in the Australian press? Because Hillary as well, because we have the first woman and the first African American big time candidates.
Oh, he is, but mind you, there's always been a very deep interest in Australia about the U.S. political system and certainly U.S. presidential races. So,
yeah.
There's a lot of interest in all the key candidates. There was a lot of interest. I mean, I was filing a lot of stories last week on Michael Bloomberg, as were other Australian journalists here. There's a lot of interest in Mitt Romney, what his chances are, and whether his Mormonism is going to be a hurdle or not. So across the spectrum, there's already not as much newsprint being filled as American papers, but a large portion of our papers, international sections of our papers, are taken up with trying to read the tea leaves as to where this very early presidential election race is going.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, what do you think about Romney's Mormonism? Is that an issue here? Because it still is something we don't know very much about in America.
There is a Mormon community in Australia, but it is much smaller than it is over here. I really don't think it's going to present an issue to vote. It's going to present more of an issue, I think, to the Republican voters who'll vote in the Republican primaries and caucuses than it will the broader American electorate. He's been very clever so far at minimizing it as an issue, saying that, insisting that his faith won't dictate his actions in the Oval Office. There have been various parallels drawn, of course, between the fact that John Kennedy's Catholicism didn't stop him getting the presidency in 1960 at a time when Catholics were very much in the minority in the U.S. So I really don't think Mitt Romney's Mormonism is going to be a problem for him than it is his perceived flip-flopping on some of the social issues of late.
Thanks, Michael, for your call. We go to Scott next from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I'm wondering if you might be able to give, a view of what should be done in Iraq from an international standpoint. I mean, we hear a lot of American journalists commenting about it, and it's obviously quite a mess over there. My concern is, as you hear from the international community and predominantly from the Democratic Party, that we need to get out of there, we need to get out of there. But nobody really has stepped forward to say, we walk away and leave a country that we've just decimated. I have an issue with it because I feel that we really screwed things up for an entire country, and just walking away from and saying we made a mess and we're going to leave a mess and you guys figure it out on your own, it's just an incredibly immoral thing to do. So I'm wondering from an international perspective, if your guests could, it's very easy to say we need to get out of there, but nobody on the opposition side has any answers whatsoever. So I'm wondering from an international perspective, if your guests could say what Australians think need to be done and how do we fix the problem, because there is a problem.
Well, in Australia's in terms of the Australian debate, there the opinion polls reflect what's happening here. There is a very strong anti-war sentiment in Australia. There are strong calls to pull Australian troops out, and it's going to be an issue in the national election campaign later this year, with the Prime Minister still determined to provide support to his close friend and professional colleague George Bush, but on the other side of the spectrum, the opposition leader Kevin Rudd going to the election with a very strong troop withdrawal deadline platform. There really hasn't been a lot of thought in Australia either as to what you do if troops are pulled out. I made the reference before to a Vietnam-style withdrawal. That was probably a misstatement, because America, Australia, other members of the international community couldn't afford to do what happened in Vietnam, and that is pull every last Western soldier out of the country. There's going to have to be some residual force to maintain security in Baghdad or provide support to whatever Iraqi government exists next year or in 2009. How big will that force be? What powers will it have to intervene in any new flare-ups of sectarian violence? What happens if the country goes from bad to worse? Do we send troops back in? These are things that really weren't thought out back in the days before March 2003, and George Bush and John Howard and various other supporters of the invasion of Iraq are now paying the consequences for that.
More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political this hour. Michael Rowland is our guest, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. 800, thanks, Scott, for your call. We have a couple lines open at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up following the news from National Public Radio, we will be talking about the cost of college and whether or not there are loans available, how many students take loans, and looking a little bit at how much indebtedness there is on the part of many students once they graduate. So we'll be speaking with the financial aid head of the whole services at UW Whitewater, and that's coming up the second hour of our show. All right, more phone calls from Michael. Michael is the Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Fine guest.
He's all right, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
someone in the Beltway who's outside the Beltway.
Right,
very
right.
Very good.
Yeah.
I have two related questions. One is, as an outsider and as an Australian and someone who comes from a country with the Westminster system, does the guest find it curious that after a major election, which could be considered a referendum on the war policy, Iraq in general, a negative referendum, that there isn't a change in policy and the party which got the majority of the vote doesn't insist on a change? You know, so do Australians find that curious? And then the second thing is, does Australia, like most other Commonwealth countries and much of the Western world, realize that the Iraq war is illegal? And is that part of the critique of the participation of Australia by the general population? And thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
And thank you. On the second part, the perceived illegality of the war is something that has been taken up by some of the more virulent anti-war campaigners in Australia. But the large bulk of people who oppose the war, they may or may not think it was illegal in the first place, but they're just sick to death of the daily trail of carnage in Baghdad and in various other parts of the country. And grimly thankful for the fact that the Australian death toll has been all of one, maybe two soldiers dying in Iraq since 2003, compared to your 35, nearly 3,600. On the first part of the question, one of the benefits of the Westminster system on governments is, say, for instance, our opposition party does win the election this year with a strong campaign, with a platform to start pulling Australian troops out of Iraq. Because there is no separation of the executive and the legislature in Australia, the very first act of the newly anointed Prime Minister Kevin Rudd would be to do just that, to put the wheels in motion and start pulling US troops out. No negotiation with a president down the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, no arm twisting, the arms of recalcitrant members of your own party in Congress. The benefits of Westminster is that if you get the votes, you have the untrammeled authority to bring in your policies.
And thanks so much for your call, Frank. Let's go next to Don from Marshfield. Hi, Don.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity. Interested in particular in your guest's explanation of the Australian system for campaign finance, since I think that's one of the core problems in this country, in this plutocracy that we call a democracy, of the corrupting influence of money. And I'd be interested in how campaign finance, public campaign finance, is carried out in Australia.
Okay. Whoops, there we go.
Certainly much more transparent than it is over here. As I said earlier, the two main political parties do accept large wads of money from our equivalent of the Federal Electoral Commission, and therefore the scope for private individuals, for big corporations to try to influence policy by forking out large sums of money to candidates and parties is fairly minimal. So in many respects, luckily, our system hasn't got anywhere near as wide open, despite the campaign finance laws of a couple of years ago, that that this system has become. And also, luckily, candidates don't have to spend every waking hour going out there and trying to raise money, private money, because they do know that they, at the end of the day, can and will accept large portions of taxpayer money to fund their respective campaigns.
So the money is provided by a tax base, is that correct?
Yeah, certainly a large amount of the money is provided by a tax base. There's a well-entrenched system of both parties accepting, in a very transparent way, a certain amount of funds from the taxpayer, but they can build on that with their own campaign finance activities, be it through individual fundraising and through albeit limited handouts from some of the big Australian companies.
Is there pressure from moneyed interests or very wealthy corporations and individuals to involve themselves in campaigns or not?
There always is, but what you'll find if you look at the records, the public disclosure records from Australian election campaigns in recent elections, is that Australian companies have got very very cluey in that they tend to donate more or less the same amount of money to both political parties. It's called in Australia having a two-way bet to make sure that you are viewed favourably by either party, whatever the outcome of the election. So there isn't. It happens in some respects, but there isn't a situation where one party, in historically it's been the conservative Republican-style party of the current Prime Minister, receiving large wads of money from the corporate sector at the expense of the other party, which is more of a democratic socialist-based party, ending up with just simply contributions from unions.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. Brett is next from Pewaukee. Hello, Brett.
Thanks, Kathleen. Interesting program. How has the Australian John Howard Conservatives dealt with global warming? And sort of what can Australia teach America on how to address this issue now that the president at least admits that it exists? So,
our Prime Minister has changed his view on climate warming, and I think it was hard for any Australian leader to maintain that climate change wasn't a problem while we endured that crippling drought that went on for years and still basically has got large parts of Australia in its grip. He has now become more open to the idea that, yes, there are ways of minimising the human impact on the environment. There are ways of sensibly going about reducing carbon emissions. We have a very big coal industry in Australia, and as we all know, the coal industry is one of the key emitters of greenhouse gases. He hasn't certainly become a rabid environmentalist overnight, but he's certainly become more willing to accept the other side of the climate change argument than certainly George Bush has been in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Well, a similar question from Judy from Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Because you all in Australia are closer to the South Pacific Island nations, I'm curious to know what global warming, what the impact has been. It's my understanding that on some of the islands, people are moving further inland because they are actually losing landmass.
Well, that's right, and those sort of stories do get much wider coverage in our papers and our radio and TV stations, given the sheer geography of where we are. There are studies that show some of the smaller Pacific Islands in 50, 60, 70 years will be almost underwater because of steadily rising sea levels. So when you factor the coverage of that into the coverage of what the drought has done, about the studies that show the detrimental impact of the emissions from our hundreds of coal plants around Australia, and you've got an Australian public that is acutely aware of the climate change issue, and so much so that alongside Iraq, It is going to be the key election issue this year, which if you asked anybody even 4 years ago whether climate change would be up there as an issue our major politicians were talking about, they would have laughed in your face.
How long has this drought gone on in Australia, Michael?
I can't be quite precise, but it's certainly been 2 or 3 years, if not slightly longer. And it's led to extremely tight water restrictions in our major capital cities, restrictions on watering plants, watering lawns, washing cars. And in some country towns, there's even been a debate that continues to this day of recycling sewage for domestic water use. That is how serious the drought issue has become.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Judy, so much for your call.
You're welcome.
Let's go next to Joe from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm wondering what kind of healthcare system you have in Australia.
We have that universal healthcare system that a lot of critics of universal healthcare systems like to deride. It's a system called Medicare, and it works. What happens is that each Australian taxpayer, each fiscal year, pays a set portion of their income, usually ranging between, I think of late, it's 3 to 5%. That all goes into a federally funded pool, which in turn results in the fact that no matter who you are in Australia, you can, if you've got a serious health issue, you can go to a hospital and be fairly sure that you'll get treatment. There is a private healthcare system built on top of that, and the government has been encouraging more people to take out private health insurance to ease the strain on the public healthcare system. But by and large, the universal healthcare system does work well. It's worked very well in Australia for decades, and I have to say one thing, Kathleen, and it's one of the things I most miss about being in the US and not in Australia, having had exposure to the US health system now for a couple of years.
Oh, that's interesting.
Plenty of ways you can fix it.
Yeah, and we've been talking about it for years now. Let me ask your thoughts on that in terms of the various plans being put forward by presidential candidates. Will they all have to put forward, do you think, a very complete plan because this system is broken?
I think they will, and it's certainly going to be one alongside immigration, one of the key domestic issues discussed. But, you know, it comes down to the fact that I think the more Americans know about the potential benefits, and there are downsides. There are downsides in any government government policy, centralized government policy. But when Americans see the benefits of systems like the one we've got in Australia and the ones that exist in some European countries such as France, the option of getting organized and overcoming inbuilt aversions of setting up a universal healthcare system would be pretty attractive to a lot of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. We go to John next from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning to you both. First off, I'd like to just make a comment. I don't know that much about the Australian government, but I really don't think much of the government down there. When I first was aware of a few years back and how the people of Australia would allow that government to take away the private ownership of firearms and destroy their firearms.
That happened.
How did that happen, Michael?
That the catalyst for that was an event in the state of Tasmania in 1996. It was a mass shooting. A fellow walked into a coffee shop in a national park in that state and killed, I forget the toll, but it was between 35 and 40 people on the scale, more or less, of the recent Virginia Tech massacre. And that was one of the worst mass shootings in Australian history, and it concentrated the minds of politicians across the spectrum. And as a result, very quickly afterwards, the Australian Prime Minister, Mr. Howard, who only recently had been elected, took the step with the unanimous support from other political parties to bring in very, very tough gun control laws, which continue to this day. And I have to say, their gun laws, by and large, of course, if you're a gun owner in Australia, you'd think otherwise, but by and large, continue to be very popular.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting, your government's response to that and our continuing debate about this issue that goes on and on and on. We have a very strong gun lobby.
You do indeed, and I have spent some time looking at it and writing stories. And certainly, I was down on the campus of Virginia Tech back in April and covered the subsequent political debate back here in Washington. The gun lobby in Australia is nowhere near as entrenched as it is over here, but the culture of gun ownership in Australia is nowhere near as entrenched as here.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, we have farmers who, by every right, should have guns to go about their daily business, but we don't have the constitutional right to bear arms, and as a result, the ownership of guns in metropolitan areas is relatively minuscule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Michael, how do you like this assignment, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation? Is it okay, or do you miss home?
Oh, listen, I'm starting to miss home. I'm just reaching the halfway period. It's 2 years into a four-year posting. But by and large, it's been terrific. I've found Americans to be wonderful people. I've managed, as one of your previous callers said, to get out of the Beltway as much as possible, and you find that people outside Washington are even nicer, particularly in Wisconsin.
And
it's been good. It's just been a really good learning curve coming, you know, getting involved in your into the inner workings of your government, some of the key social issues, and also covering some of those off-the-beaten-track stories that your country provides plentiful opportunities to do so. It's been, I'm loving it, and I'm sure we'll continue to love it.
Yeah, Michael, thanks so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. You're a great guest. Thanks.
It's been a pleasure.
Michael Rowland, Washington correspondent for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He's been with them for 18 years and was with us this hour to be a part of our All Things Political conversation, which takes place on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock, and we thank him. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Sharome Owens for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and stay with us. We have more Monday morning conversation. If you're interested in college, you'll want to be sure to stay tuned for the next hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.